This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're going to be talking about exercise and getting moving and why it's important and how to maybe do it a little bit better. But before we go there, I've been recently touching on logical thinking, reasoning, how to make good decisions and how to argue effectively and appropriately and how to listen to arguments. And we've tried to concentrate on having you think about two things that seems important is when you're listening to people trying to convince you of something, no matter how well they do it, how well thought of they are, how passionate they are, what's the evidence that they're presenting, how reasonable is that evidence, and then what's the logic of their argument. And we've talked about a number of those issues. But today I want to mention another logical fallacy, which is often described as the moving goalpost. And this is where the person who's listening denies your arguments, even though they may be well-established, good, well-facts, and well-logical, and they keep saying, well, but what about this? As you lay proof down for one of your premises, then they move another one. And I don't want to pick on evolution, but it's so easy. For a long time after Darwin came out with his ideas about evolution, people said, well, this, you know, that can't be, and there's no way that that can be propagated and new variation can occur. There's no mechanism for that. And then genes were discovered, particularly by Mendel's work. And another common one that's been used against evolution is how could something as complicated as an eye evolve over time? And now that's been very, very clearly worked out from very, very, very simple, almost one and two cell light-receiving organs in some primitive organisms and up to the very complicated eyes that humans do. So don't let people keep changing the goalposts or the goal line on you when you're arguing. That's not good arguments either. So what if I were to tell you we could increase your life 14 years? A recent study coming out of England and Europe called the Prospective Investigation of Cancer Study found that if you do four things, you can extend your life by an estimated 4 years. Don't smoke. It's not rocket science. Just drink in moderation. Eat lots of fruits and vegetables in your diet, and then don't be totally sedentary. Keep moving. And so we're going to talk about how to incorporate movement and activity more easily and more appropriately and hopefully more consistently in your life today. And I'm going to do that with Jenny Grupp. Jenny is in the studio with me today. She's a exercise and fitness professional. She's been in Alaska for 4 years. And I want to say welcome to Line One.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit about the whole topic of exercise science, exercise physiology. Everything is getting more and more detailed, and in my time, I don't think there was much there, but there's increasingly a lot of real, true, good research going on in this area, it seems to me.
Yes, there is, and it's a very exciting time, and it's fun to read the new research that's coming out, and a lot of things that we kind of took for granted are now being quantified, and it's a lot of fun to be involved in the industry. Exercise physiology is specifically the study of how exercise alters the structure and function of the human body. And so when I was studying exercise science, we focused more specifically on movement patterns and how does the body move, what is the best way for the body to move, how can you avoid injury by moving properly. And so that's where my background comes from.
And a lot of, I guess, the exercise science aspect relates around competitive athletics, but it seems a branch of that, or at least some of the information coming out of the research, is really effective to all of us on a daily basis.
Absolutely. And as the population is aging, and you know, there's lots of talk about the baby boom generation, and as those folks are now moving into a later stage of their life, they're looking at how can I do this without shuffling from point A to point B? How can I be 70, 80, 90 years old and still be active, still be healthy and enjoying life, which is a very different look at the aging process versus what it was even 20 years ago. And so a lot of the studies that previously had been done on super high-end athletes and college athletes and professional athletes are now looking at how we can prolong the fitness and general overall health of folks as they're getting older.
You know, the argument always comes up. Nevertheless, we're living longer. I mean, I use this argument myself. We constantly are worried about our diet and things that might be in our diet and what our environmental exposures are. Yet, as a civilization, we're living longer now than anyone has ever lived or any humans have ever lived. We've also stressed, however, that in this country, we're falling behind other countries. And so how does this all fit with the idea that we still need to be moving more?
Well, a lot of the folks that we are falling behind are populations that we consider less affluent or who have less of the modern conveniences that we have. So they are living longer and living better because they have to, in their daily life, in order to get from point A to point B, to go and have a drink of water. They can't walk over to the faucet. You know, for us, that expends maybe 10, 15 calories. We walk over, we get our water. We may add some flavoring to it, which adds calories and things like that. Whereas in other populations, to go and get water means maybe going to a fountain in the middle of town. Maybe it means walking a few miles, getting the water, bringing it back, perhaps boiling it, perhaps distilling it. So there's a lot more daily physical activity that helps to keep the body active, helps to keep the mind young, keeps blood circulating through the muscles, keeps the muscles active throughout life.
You know, I've been fortunate enough one time to at least go to France and in Europe, and my observation there was, although there were lots of people smoking, it was still a much more active group of people, it would appear to me, just from a very casual observation.
Absolutely. And some of that is even things as simple as the way cities are set up. So in France and in various European countries, you have small town centers where there's every town has their bakery, they have their butcher shop, they have their fruit and vegetable stand. And so I can walk a few blocks to go and get my groceries and do my grocery shopping, or I'm going a few blocks away. So that's walking to one store, then walking to the other store, then carrying those packages home. And that's just daily living. There is no get on the bus necessarily and going for miles and miles, or hopping in the car and driving 40 miles to the nearest Walmart. It doesn't happen. So rather than sitting for that 40 minutes or an hour, which is what we do, they are walking and moving and carrying and using their muscles for those 40 minutes. It makes a big difference over time.
There's some, you know, it almost kind of makes some intuitive sense, but you've got to be careful about what seems to be. I mean, you could look out the window as far as you can say and say, well, the earth is flat. It turns out that's not true. It seems logical to say if we move more, that's better. Are there ways we can quantify? Are there things we know now for sure that are better because or can be improved because we move?
Things like arthritis are definitely, for folks who are able to keep active longer, there is more lubrication in the joints. And so arthritis, actually, the hardest issue or the biggest issue for people with arthritis is that ache in the joints. And so it makes you intuitively not want to move. Well, the more you move that joint, the more lubrication you get into that joint. And then that will feel better for a little while. So the more you can move on a daily basis, the better that will feel. That's just one example of.
Yeah. And we burn off exercise, so we're our calories, I'm sorry, by movement, so mm-hmm. that decreases and helps control weight.
Absolutely.
And I suspect mood's clearly associated with more activity.
Yeah.
I think about it, and it's one of the, I think, pretty well documented aids for depression is just being able to move around some.
Absolutely. And there are studies out there that show that a certain amount of movement is actually more effective at decreasing symptoms of depression than antidepressants are. Mm-hmm. And so if by getting out and moving, I mean, the human body is made to move. It's not created to sit at a desk all day. It is made to move. We have our muscles are set up in a certain way so that we can move and so that we can lift and we can throw and do all of these things. And as our lifestyle has taken away some of that, it's not something you think about over time. Great, there's all these modern conveniences and great changes that make me much more efficient. I can sit in my house at my desk all day. I can have my groceries delivered. It's all easier, but it's not necessarily better.
Those of you who are listening to Line 1 today know that you're listening to a program on exercise and encouraging everyone to understand the importance and how to begin to do that more if you're not, or how to improve what you're already doing. My guest is Jenny Grupp, who is a fitness and exercise professional. If you've got questions or comments or would like to have more information that we're not addressing, here's some ways to get a hold of us. You can dial us direct at 550-8433. If you're outside of the Anchorage immediate area, there's a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as you may well be aware, you can email me at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. All of these are ways to get a hold of us between now and 3 o'clock Anchorage time. If you're listening between 7 and 8, it's a taped rebroadcast. Jenny, what about starting later in life? What about people who, for one reason or another, are homebound or in a wheelchair? Or I'm getting at, is there too late of a time, a time to say, oh, well, I might as well just sit here and watch the football game?
Absolutely not. There are more and more studies showing that everyone can build muscle at any age. So whether you are in your 90s, and they have done studies with people in nursing homes who are over 85, and they have given them simple things, little bicep curls with 1 pound weights. A 1 pound weight is the equivalent of a can of soup in your kitchen. Take that, lift it a few times a day, you are able to build muscle. As soon as you start building that muscle and moving that muscle, you have more strength, you're able to do more. So it just really builds on itself. So there's really no reason that you should not be able to do some sort of exercise. Even if you can't leave your home, there are things that you can do around your home. If you do have enough mobility where you can walk up and down stairs in your home, do that 4 or 5 times. What you'll do when you do that 4 or 5 times in a row is get your heart rate up. So that will start working on a little bit of aerobic capacity. It will increase your energy because now you've increased your blood flow to your brain as well as to all of your muscles. If you don't have stairs in your home, you can, if you're sitting watching TV or you're watching that football game, well, guess what? There's commercial breaks. Each one of them is 1 to 2 minutes long. So during that 1 to 2 minutes, stand up, walk in place. Again, it'll get your heart rate up. 1 to 2 minutes doesn't sound like a very long time, but when you're doing some sort of movement, aerobic type activity for that long, you will notice that your heart rate will go up and you'll have some of these positive changes, elevated mood. You may not feel like sitting back down right away.
One of the corollary comments in the study I referred to earlier on the longitudinal cancer study that identified the four things we've mentioned that can, on average, increase your lifespan 14 years was this issue of movement. A kind of bit of information that I thought was interesting is it really may not be how much what we would expect, what describe as active exercise, that means jogging, running, rowing, swimming, that's important. It's this more day-to-day, all-day-long movement because that's such a much bigger part of our day. Is that fit with what you've been learning or what you've been told?
Absolutely, and it's something that I encourage all of my clients to do. And some of those things can be as simple as, we've all heard, park all the way at the end of the parking lot and walk to the store that you need to go to. But it can make a very big difference in terms of not having that excuse of, I couldn't make it to the gym, so I didn't work out today. The more you can move on a daily basis from the time you wake up in the morning until the time you go to bed, the better off you'll be. And this ties into the ACSM guidelines, which is the American College of Sports Medicine, as well as the guidelines that now the federal government has put out for activity during the day. And we often get caught up in the, oh, if I can't do half an hour at the gym on the treadmill, I can't do anything today. Well, that's not true. The studies are showing that if you can do a 10-minute bout here and 10 minutes later on in the day, or 5 minutes here, 3 minutes there, you'll still get some benefit from that.
Why would someone want to even strengthen their muscles at 85?
Because they want to get out of their chair. Okay. And often it's that simple, because they want to be able to stand and not have someone take care of them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was thinking, and I don't know the right answer to the question either. I was just thinking, why would someone want to start doing it? But, I mean, clearly, not only just with exercise strengthen muscle, it moves joints.
Mm-hmm.
And then it made me think about, there's been some very good information coming out. And at my age, I'm beginning to notice it. We don't have as good a balance as we used mm-hmm. to have. So falls are more of an issue, and strength would help that. But there are exercises that help people's balance. We didn't talk about this beforehand. Is that something that you've heard of also?
Yes, and it's also something that I'm working on more and more with all of my clients. There's, along with balance, is stability of the joints, because we think that as long as I can lift this big heavy weight, I'll be fine. Well, if your joint is not stable and you're taking that big heavy weight and pressing it up over your head, well, your shoulder joint is going to move around a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so that can lead to an injury if you can't control that weight coming down. If you take that to a walking type situation, especially here in Alaska, you start to slip on the ice. If you don't have any sort of core strength, that you'll continue to go with that slippage and possibly fall and break a hip or some other body part. And so the balance is a very, very important component of just daily fitness and general overall wellness. And I start all of my clients with balance testing, and it's very simple. Stand on one foot. Once we're not 7 or 8 and playing hopscotch anymore, we don't stand on one foot. And so the body is the great compensator. I don't need to stand on one foot. I don't need to activate those muscles. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm. There they go. So by starting people with something very simple as stand on one foot and just see how long you can hold that. Can you hold it for 5 seconds? Can you hold it for 3 seconds? And working on building those muscles. And a lot of it is what's called proprioception, which is your mind's ability to perceive where you are in space without actually looking.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing that you can stand and that you're on one foot and you're not going to fall.
And the mind's doing that not because some magical way. It's getting feedback from nerves.
Mm-hmm.
So you're really back to reinforcing nerve impulses
and
so forth, right?
Yep. And reestablishing those pathways, because if you don't keep them active, then just like with the muscles, the mind says, oh, I don't need to send that signal. And so the muscles don't get that signal. They don't know how to interpret it anymore. And it just shuts off. So when you start working on things like balance, a lot of it is training your brain and to send those signals and for the muscles to then respond to those signals.
And this is not really just esoteric talk. I think there's very, very good evidence that by getting older individuals to work on balance and strength, the incidence of one of the most common problems in the elderly, falls and broken hips,
mm-hmm.
markedly decreases. And so there's clearly some benefits from doing these kinds of things.
Absolutely. And the other side of the hip fracture is, for a lot of folks, once they have gone into the hospital for a hip fracture, it has been that kind of once you go in, there's so many other things associated with that in terms of mental stress and am I ever going to recover from this? How am I ever going to get out of here? And often people who do have hip fractures don't make it out of the hospital again. And so if you have a program where you are working on balance and strength and all of those good things, you don't get into that depression cycle and you don't have the negative side of things where your brain is saying, I am never going to recover from this. So you're doing things to either prevent that from happening, or once it does happen, having the optimism that I can build strength at any age. It doesn't matter that I'm 65 or 75 and I've had this fall. There are things I can do to get out of this. And so having those options, I think, is really important.
Yeah. You've mentioned one of the exercises is very simple for balance, and I've been doing this, so I don't do it in front of my kids, but I've found that it's clear that it appears to me that my balance is not as well from riding a bike. I mean, the more mm-hmm. I ride a bike, the better it comes back. But standing on one foot, I used to think I had great balance. I don't have as much as I do. But another one is, I remember, was just standing one foot right in front of the other, like you're walking in a line from heel to toe, heel to toe.
Mm-hmm.
Are there others that you can think of off the top of your head? Are those two obviously very easy, very simple ones that seem to help?
Those are two very easy ones, and they're very accessible, because even the standing on one foot, a great way to do that is when you're brushing your teeth in the morning. Brush your teeth every day, twice a day. So doing the bottom teeth, there's 1 minute, stand on one foot, change to the top, change your foot. It's a very easy way to do it. There are things that get a little bit more complex, like single leg squats and things like that, but they're a little bit farther along. Something else that's easy to do if you do go to the gym or do any sort of working out, if you're doing something like a bicep curl or an overhead press, again, stand on one foot when you're doing that. So as you're doing pretty much any activity, standing in line at the grocery store, stand on one foot. Change feet, stand on the other foot. It's the easiest and probably most effective way to get it in every day, and you'll see improvements quickly.
Let me remind our listeners again, you're listening to Line 1. My guest today is Jenny Grupp. She's a fitness and performance expert. If you've got questions or comments or would just like to give us a call and talk about your experiences, 550-8433 will get you through to us today. We're here till 3 o'clock or just before, 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email directly to us at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. How fast, just to give perhaps some listeners are out there that may be older about starting these programs and the safety of starting them. I like the idea of taking a can of soup. I mean, that's pretty doggone easy. So how fast should people be initiating that? Let's say if you're 75 to 80 years of age and working on some strength things and balance things that we've talked about.
The most important thing in any exercise program is going to be listening to what your body tells you. And for a lot of people, that's a little tricky because we have in our head, I should be able to lift 10 pounds. Great. That may or may not happen today. So the most important thing is start slow with something that, like a can of soup. You know you can lift a can of soup, lift it 10 times. You want to control any sort of downward motion. You want to be able to stop any weight that you're picking up. So if you move on from your can of soup to, say, a bag of rice, well, you're going from 1 pound to 5 pounds. Okay, that's not so bad. But if you can lift that, say, in a bicep curl, so you're just bending your elbow, lifting that up, if you can't take that down and control it, that's when those injuries happen, is when you are unable to control the downward motion or the eccentric portion of your motion. So being able to control those on the down is going to be important. You want to be feeling the next day maybe like, hey, I've worked my muscles yesterday. I feel a little bit of muscle soreness. You do not want to be crippling yourself, nor should any personal trainer or other fitness professional ever have you so that the next day you're unable to move. You want to feel like you've worked your muscles, like your muscles are going through some recovery and building, but listen to what your body says. If you're actually experiencing pain as opposed to muscle fatigue, stop what you're doing and consult somebody and get some good advice about what you need to be doing.
How fast should an individual, again, let's say 75 to 85, begin to experience and notice improvements?
Usually there's a kind of a 6-week window is the standard
rule of thumb.
Thank you. Yes. Mm-hmm. And so 6 weeks is the portion at which your body, after 1 or 2 days, you're probably not going to notice much different. You'll notice that maybe you have a little bit more energy. Maybe you feel like you want to repeat that action. But your body's saying, that was interesting. I'll make these little improvements, but I'm not going to go crazy making these changes. After the 3, 4, 5 weeks of consistent repetition of those actions, your body starts to think, you're serious. You're going to make some changes. You're going to be really keeping up with this. So now I'm going to start to really kick in and make some serious changes. And that's right about that 6-week window is where you start to notice some real changes and you may start to notice things like, hey, I've got a little bit of muscle. You'll actually be able to see some of that muscle tone developing. But before that, if you do see some, that's great. But if you don't, you're not missing out on anything. You're not wasting your time. It's happening. It just may not be visible.
Okay. Thanks very much. We have a caller. I want to take Joel's call. Joel, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, doctor. I've been exercising regularly for quite a few years, and sometimes, like, you know, you were talking about one-legged squats.
Mm-hmm.
I was curious, does that damage your knees any? Because sometimes I notice some pain in my knees after doing it the next day in the joints. But I was just wondering if maybe possibly I could be doing some damage to my knees.
What's probably happening there is going to be based on the form of your squat. Squatting, if it's done incorrectly, can put a tremendous amount of pressure onto the knees and can, over time, especially if you're doing it repetitively, can cause injuries. The most important thing with a squat is going to be really to keep your weight a little bit back on your heels so that it's your glutes and your quads that are doing all of that work and not the knees. So if you're feeling it in your knees, there's probably something not quite right in the way that you're holding yourself as you perform your squat.
Okay. So keep your weight more on your heels, huh?
Mm-hmm. And when you're pushing up, coming out of your squat, try and push through that heel so it'll get a little bit more action in your glutes and that'll get a little bit more stabilization for you.
Uh-huh. Okay. So do you recommend hanging on to anything while you do your squats or just standing?
It depends on what your goals are. So if you are, do you mean holding on like to assist you with balance or do you mean lifting like a barbell on your shoulders?
I don't want to put any extra stress on my knees. You know,
right.
I want to,
sure.
The reason I want to do it is just to stay flexible, you know, and not, you know, to be able to not get,
not be injured.
Lose my flexibility.
Right. I would say there's nothing wrong with initially holding on for a little bit of assistance with that balance, but your goal, I think, is going to be able to do that without any sort of balance assistance.
Yeah. I don't use anything to balance with, but
good.
I have noticed sometimes I just wonder, you know, I feel a little bit of pain in my knee the next day, and I just wonder, you know, I don't want to do any damage. I'm wanting to do good.
Absolutely. And like I said, if you are experiencing that kind of pain, it's probably going to be form-related. And so you might want to get some assistance with that, maybe contact someone locally who can help you out with figuring out how what your form is in that position. Because knee pain in a squat is not unusual if they're done incorrectly.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Also had an email. I think this is probably more of a promotional kind of email. At least there's three questions, one of which I think is – again, fairly easy to agree with, but the writer is Diane, and she says, walking is the easiest way to exercise, but not if a city's land use code and development does not promote that. Please help your audience beware that the health of a population starts with how a city is developed. A walkable city is number one, even in a northern city like Anchorage. Simply having a good public transit system has been shown to improve and promote health. Please add in our wonderful trail system and cross country. So, your thoughts. I have thoughts on those comments.
I agree 100%. The cities that have more easily accessible bicycle trails, walking trails, definitely have a healthier population. When they do, you know, whether it's a study that's been done by Men's Health magazine or something a little bit more scientific where they talk about the healthiest or not so healthy cities, it's consistent that cities that do have a good, safe place for people to get out and walk are healthier. Absolutely.
I always like to just think about perspective. There's no argument about Diane's comments. The argument is that we developed our cities before we realized we needed to be moving more, and now we're having to backtrack and do that. And I'd certainly recommend making cities more exercise friendly, and I think that's really on the being happening or going to happen. There was recently a conference here about outdoors activity and increasing our outdoors activity. And we're actually going to interview an individual who's very involved in that kind of activity, and we certainly have the right kind of state and the ease of getting to outdoor activities, which we haven't done as much as we should have either. Another couple of calls coming in as well. Let's see. Charles, have I got you on the line?
Yes.
What can we do for you?
Question regarding, arthritis and joint problems related to movement. I heard your guest talking about how you need to movement is good for lubricating the joints and getting you an arthritic joint to move better. What is the role of or the result of inflammation? And I guess I'm saying this because it seems like doctors will prescribe taking a long-term bout of anti-inflammatory drugs for an arthritic condition. At least that's what happened in my case. But and it seems like movement doesn't make things feel better.
Well, as far as inflammation, yes, the it often happens that long-term anti-inflammatories are prescribed. That's things like previously had been Vioxx, those types of drugs. Arthritis is an inflammation in the joint, and I believe there's some difference between the way the joint is inflamed, whether it's rheumatoid or whether it's osteoarthritis. Anti-inflammatories are great in terms of using things like antioxidants, which is what I recommend to my clients, which is not necessarily a pharmaceutical as much as the more fruits and veggies that you eat, things like dark chocolate, all have antioxidants which help to control some of that inflammation and then thereby reducing some of that inflammation, making things slightly more comfortable. And again, with the movement, trying to help lubricate those joints and get things feeling better, it's not going to be the same kind of feeling better that you would get from a drug. It's going to be something more keeping you moving over a longer period of your life. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, I guess it seems like movement itself isn't helping very much, and with diet, of course, there are long-term issues there.
But have you tried
movement? Movement itself seems to be not improving my situation any.
Have you tried any sort of water type activity? The National Arthritis Foundation, I believe, recommends things like water aerobic type activities.
Okay. I can do lots of things, but just one.
I think this is a much more complex issue than may at first appear, Charles. Just as from a physician standpoint, for example, some arthritis patients don't have the articular cartilage. They don't have the lubrication. They can't lubricate. That is not meaning that you shouldn't move, but that certain activities may be better to help you take advantage of movement if you're not weight-bearing, such as in swimming, for example. And so I wouldn't...
All right, yeah, it's a much more complex issue, I agree.
Yeah, it is. But the basic idea is if we can move, we keep those joints lubricated is one word, but also we keep the movement around those joints. If we don't move a joint, it will become less and less mobile, and you're trying to keep mobility as well by movement. So there's a lot of other benefits as well. It sounds like you may have a very significant problem, and keep talking with professionals about what you might do to keep helping yourself.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Julie, are you on the line?
Yes.
All right. What can we do for you?
First, I want to definitely endorse what your guest just said about swimming, because I have extensive arthritis, and it used to be almost crippling. And then I went back to swimming daily, which I had done in my youth before I had arthritis, and it just worked miracles for my arthritis, just swimming daily.
Great.
But my question that I originally called in about was, I wanted to know if your guests could recommend types of exercises for someone who has had a total knee replacement. Mine's 2 years old, best thing I ever did. But I've recently decided to return to downhill skiing. The orthopedic surgeon had said that that I could do that, but he didn't recommend any exercises to make the task easier. And so I was just wondering what your guests thought about people who've had a total knee replacement returning to alpine skiing, and if she had any recommendations on exercises.
Congratulations on even wanting to get back to alpine skiing. I think that's wonderful, and I'm very happy that the swimming has made a big difference in your arthritis. That's wonderful, wonderful news. As far as specific exercises for knee replacement is not my specialty, so I'm a little hesitant to recommend specific exercises. What you're doing right now, and what I would recommend for folks who are going to be skiing generally would be things like squats. I'm not sure how that is affected with a knee replacement. But what you're going to want to do is work on some core stability. Will help with your balance and will help with your skiing overall. And so, again, some of those single leg type exercises are going to help. Working on exercises that will strengthen your glute muscles are going to help with your skiing. Have you been skiing before?
I learned 10 years ago. So I learned when I was 44, 10 years ago. So I'm not somebody who's skied all my life, but I really loved it, learning it in middle age.
Great.
And what I notice is, having now skied several times this season for the first time in several years, I hadn't skied for the 2 years since the knee replacement, and then I couldn't ski for the year prior to the knee replacement because I was on crutches.
Oh,
so after a three-year hiatus from skiing, I'm sort of, you know, I'm definitely rusty. But what I notice is that, unlike swimming, which of course is heavenly on your joints, that skiing, you really can take kind of a pounding if you're out of shape, and I certainly am out of shape currently. So I assume that I have to do is strengthen all of the muscles in my legs.
Absolutely. And again, some core strengthening is going to go a long way to help you with your balance and maintaining your upright position when you're skiing. Cycling will be a great thing for you. Because some, you know, if you think, I had a ski instructor who once spoke to me about how, you know, you do, you're bringing your one ski around and bringing the other one around, and he compared it to riding a bicycle and pushing the pedal down, bringing it up, that kind of thing. And so definitely some cycling will be, I think, a good thing for you because of a couple of things. One is it's non-impact, so it won't hurt your joints. And it will, again, simulate that type of motion, that, you know, one leg kind of doing one thing and then the other one moving around in front, the up-down motion of it.
Oh, okay. I hadn't thought of that.
And by core, just to make sure we get that, you're talking about abdominal strength, back strength, and so forth.
It's, yeah, more or less. The core is really anything that is not a limb. So it includes your hips, but not your legs. It includes your shoulder girdle, but not your arm. Okay. So things like, if you're familiar with a plank type position, you're in sort of a push-up position, and you're working on the phrase I use all the time is belly button back to your spine. So you're constantly engaging those muscles in your middle. It includes the muscles in your back and as I was saying, the muscles of your hips, so your glutes, more of the stabilizing muscles there. And so that's going to be, again, some of that single leg type movement that will help.
If I can just add one more thing about your whole campaign for getting people out and moving more, I'd really like to encourage everybody who's listening who's overweight and maybe has lived in Alaska and never bothered to learn to ski because they figured, well, I'm old, I'm overweight, I'm out of shape. When I learned at 44, I was about 35 pounds heavier than I am now, and I'm still overweight. So back then I was obese, and I learned to ski partly because of a dare from my foster son. But I was surprised at how much I liked it. And anybody can learn to ski. It's just wonderful. So I just want to put in that plug. That's all. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.
Let's see. I was just going through. We got a bunch of phone calls. We got some questions. Let's go ahead and take another phone call, if you don't mind. Lynn, you're on line one. Hold on just a second. We're working to get to you. Lynn?
It's Lynn, yes.
Yeah.
Thank
hey,
you.
What can we do for you?
Well, I started working out after quitting smoking, and and now I've got tendonitis and carpal tunnel. And so I kind of want to ask your guest is, you know, there was nothing else to me that could have caused this, so I'm wanting to ask, working out incorrectly can do that. And number two, stress to people out there that when you're working out, be informed yourself. Don't rely on anybody else to really, like, tell you what's right for your body.
Excellent advice. And yes, things like carpal tunnel, I haven't known specifically to be caused by any type of working out, not knowing what sort of protocol you're following right now. But it can certainly, tendonitis and things like carpal tunnel can definitely be exacerbated by incorrect movement.
Okay.
So it would
or moving too fast through. Am I wrong about that? I think of carpal tunnel as a repetitive motion kind of injury, which would be a lot. But I wondered if tendonitis couldn't be started by going too fast, to lifting weights too much, or doing too much exercise too quick.
It's often the jump in with both feet. You know, I'm doing too much too soon, mm-hmm. kind of thing okay. that can exacerbate that. The carpal tunnel could be if you're doing bicep curls and you're not keeping your wrist completely straight. If your hand is face up and you're letting your the top of your hand kind of fall back when you're doing your bicep curls, that
right.
could be exacerbating some of the carpal tunnel issues. There you go. doing some very light 1 pound weight wrist curls in the opposite direction, going from a flat wrist position to pulling that up and then coming back to flat, so not letting it drop back down again, should work to strengthen a little some of those muscles and work on evening that out a bit and helping to relieve some of those symptoms.
Thank you so much. This is a great show.
Thank you.
Kiddo. We've got a number of emails, no more callers on the line, so I want to take a quick break, and I want to talk about yoga. Yoga is one of those things that, as a skeptic, I've been skeptical about, and yet I think I need to learn more, and I'm quite honest about that. You're an expert in the area, so educate me on yoga. Where'd all this come from? What's it about? Why is it good? How come it's so popular? Those are things that come to my mind.
Okay, well, it's been around for a long time. It seems lately it's been making the news a lot more, and so it seems to be a bit more trendy, but it's actually a practice that there's evidence that yoga has been practiced in India for the last 5,000 years, and potentially even longer than that. It is a wonderful, I like to think of it as the world's first wellness program. It really incorporates every aspect of your life, depending on where you want to take it. What we do now here in the States and in the gym-type facilities is we focus on the physical practice, which is also called the asanas, and that is simply the postures and the poses that are associated with yoga. The some other aspects of yoga include things like what you're eating, how you take care of yourself, doing no harm to others, things along those lines. And so it can give you a total wellness because it can encourage you to eat better and take better care of yourself overall, as well as doing these physical postures. When it was developed, one of the purposes of the asanas is to ready the body for meditation. And so if you're going to be sitting and meditating for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, an hour, 6 hours, there are certain things that your body wants to do to be able to sit for that long, because most of us can't just sit down and quiet our mind. And so yoga looks at how to quiet your mind and what happens when we do quiet our mind, when we're able to tune out all of the head trash and all of the things that go on in our day-to-day, all the little stresses, how we become more aware of what's going on in our body, how we move our body, and all of those things are wonderful, and they really can make a big difference in your life.
What you know me, I'm a skeptic here. What's the evidence for yoga? And I guess I'm specifically in my mind more interested in the physical aspects, the strengthening of. I've heard people who have gotten into yoga say it's really a very difficult thing. It's one of the hardest sets of exercises they've done, which to my simple mind says, what? Wait a minute. So help me understand what we know, why we know that it's working, and what are those physical things that it's helping us achieve and improve.
And the skepticism is very, very common, actually, and especially among folks who either have been doing other sorts of exercise for a while or just don't really know a lot about it. There are actually thousands of studies on yoga. A lot of them are based in India, and they include things like studies on the military in India. So you've got a very structured atmosphere where folks have been practicing yoga and how that affects what they've done. And that has moved now because there is such a focus on yoga in the general population here in the United States. There's now a lot more research that's being done. Some of that is by places is being encouraged by things like Yoga Alliance, which is sort of an overreaching, for lack of a better term, an industry group that helps to support things like research and coming up with these very specific reasons why and what it's helping. So there are now studies that show that yoga helps not only it actually helps with a lot of the same things that, quote, regular exercise helps with. They've done studies in nursing homes where they've started teaching people yoga, and they have found increases in strength, better sleeping habits over time, and decrease in depression type symptoms, all of these things. And
what give me some examples of the kinds of things you would start in a group that's starting into some yoga with the idea that it's going to help your overall maybe movement and strength and so forth.
Sure. What I like to say about yoga is if you can breathe, you can do yoga. So, yes, there are poses and positions that are very hard and very challenging. Absolutely. You know, but on the first class, do you want to take your ankle and put it behind your head? No.
Not me.
Yeah. Me either.
It ain't gonna happen.
Me either. And I've been practicing for a while. But really, it's going to be a strong focus on the breath. And because most of us in our daily lives breathe in the top third of our lungs, which does a lot of things like increase stress, increase blood pressure. Studies about when you're breathing in that top third or you're breathing with an open mouth, you end up readying your body for the fight or flight reflex. And so all of these things, cortisol starts to enter into the bloodstream, adrenaline, all these things start to happen. What yoga does is focus first and foremost on your breathing. And so breathing deeply, diaphragmatic breathing, similar to what your music coaches teach singers to do. So being able to do that slows the body down, slows the mind down, allows you to start to tune into what's going on. And then from there, that's how the classes for me generally will start. And so then you start to connect the movement with the breath. So one breath, one movement. You inhale, you do one thing. You exhale, you do something else. Again, getting that rhythmic connection going. From there, then you start to move on to some of it's going to be strength type exercises. Some of them are going to be flexibility exercises. There is also a component of class which is specifically balancing poses where you are on one foot or some sort of balance pose along those lines. And so you start to build your strength. As you start to do things, you get stronger. You can do them better. And you move on to the next portion of that pose.
Okay. One of the thoughts that I came to my mind as we were talking about there, as you were talking about it, again, back to the balance issue, is it may be helpful for listeners to recognize that in our core, in our stomach and in our back and in our arms and our legs, there's opposing muscle groups. There are those that flex and extend. And so, in a sense, by balancing, you're working both of those groups is the way I'm very simplistically thinking about it. This is not my thing. So that is good as opposed to doing something that only works to build up flexing muscles. You get some balance issues, and that can lead to problems. I hear more about discussion about unbalanced muscles. Is that kind of where that comes from? That there's over-strengthening of some or under-use of others, or is that not really true?
Sort of, yes. Not an easy answer.
Okay. All right.
There's muscle imbalances, and then there is balance. Uh-huh. So muscle imbalances are going to be things where one muscle is overly tight or overly active, and the other muscle that is supposed to be balancing it is overly stretched. So a simple and some of that translates into overall balance and stability for how you stand and standing on one foot and those kinds of things. An easy way to think of this is if bicep curl is my favorite example because it's easy to picture. So when you bend that elbow, your bicep is going to contract and your tricep is going to lengthen. So if you are overdoing it with your bicep curls, which a lot of folks tend to do, then yes, that muscle will stay shortened and the tricep is going to stay lengthened. What that results in aesthetically is not very pretty triceps. But what that results in other muscles in the body will be imbalances. And so if you get into the deeper muscles in the hip area, what that can often lead to is things like low back pain, because what you'll have is the muscles on one side of your hip pulling in one direction, muscles on the other side being lengthened. They're unable to keep that dynamic support. So you no longer have muscles that are in balance, keeping your bones where they need to be, but now they're a little bit off. So when you get a little bit off, your spine moves a little bit. Now those discs, those wonderful discs that we love and that give us all of our mobility, start to maybe bulge out a little bit. They press on a nerve, and then we've got low back issues. So yoga does help with what yoga often does for a lot of the poses is there will be one aspect of strength and one aspect of flexibility. So it can go a long way toward straightening out some of those muscle imbalances or getting you to work on body parts that you wouldn't necessarily work on in the gym or that you wouldn't think to work on in the gym.
Okay. Another thing I would like to talk about is that after we had made arrangements to do this program, I stumbled on a couple of articles. Actually, probably I think they were both in the New York Times. You said you saw one maybe in the Boston Globe, but it talked about is stretching a good thing? I'm an athlete, or I've been an athlete early in my life. I'm not so sure I'm still an athlete. but what I was taught about stretching and what I still see being done is really not the best idea anymore. So I'd like you to talk about your understanding of static stretching and define that and dynamic stretching and the benefits or risks to each one of these.
Sure. The static stretching is the probably the easiest one to address in that it's the one that most people are familiar with. That's when you feel that your hamstrings are tight and you want to stretch them. So what do? You reach over and try to touch your toes. And then you stay there for a little while and then as long as you think you maybe should, and then you get up and you go on to doing something else. Or runners do this very often. They will do a quad stretch. So they'll stand on one foot, bend the other leg, grab onto that foot, stretch out the quad. Some folks still do that before they run. We'll get into the whys and wherefores of that in a minute. But that's going to be the simplest, most direct stretching. Static stretching, sit down, stand up, but stretch that muscle for 30 seconds. Is generally the rule. Dynamic stretching is more stretching in motion. And so this is a shorter term kind of stretch, come back, stretch, come back. So something that you would do for that would be there's one exercise that comes to mind called butt kickers. And what that is you stand and you do similar to a quad stretch in that you're bending your knee, but it's more of a sort of a funny-looking running motion where you're making your way down through the gym or down the block, and you're doing an exaggerated bending of the knee trying to kick your own bottom. And so that's going to be a dynamic stretch where it's you're not holding it, but you're consistently, perhaps for 30 seconds, doing this bend, straighten, bend, straighten, bend, straighten, which is also different from ballistic stretching, which is that constant bounce, 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 Jane Fonda workout kind of thing. And that's been proven to be the least desirable of all stretching is the ballistic.
All right. So I was taught, and I still see people doing this static stretching. What's the problem that's been identified, and which is better, static or dynamic?
For static stretching, what they're finding is that static stretching is very effective, which is great, but it may not be exactly what you're looking for. So static stretching, what it does is lengthen that muscle, and you hold it for 30 seconds. And after that 30 seconds, you've got other mechanisms in your muscle that are saying, okay, this is the new length of that muscle. This is where you want to be. And that's what that 30 seconds is. More than 30 seconds, it's not so much that you stretch the muscle farther, but you've kind of done what you need to do, and the body goes, okay, I'm done. So once that's been stretched out and it's at that new length, it has a hard time contracting back. So if you're doing something like a static stretch before you run, you have greater potential for injury because your body's not going to respond the way you think that it should or the way that you want it to necessarily. Mm-hmm. And that's been what they've been finding is they've got students and athletes who are stretching before and then still getting injured, but stretching's supposed to prevent injury. Mm-hmm. But if you're doing it as a pre-workout kind of stretch, it's not necessarily going to be the best thing depending on what your sport is and what you want to do.
I remember, and what caught my attention, and this was, again, it was a newspaper report of research, was that there was actually being shown that they could demonstrate weakness in muscles with the mm-hmm. static stretch, which is not what most people want to hear
right.
from doing static stretches, whereas with the dynamic stretches, that was not the case. It's kind of what I was trying to get you to say, but I want you to know if you heard the same thing, and does that make sense?
Yes, and it absolutely makes sense. And so just as I was saying, the muscle is unable to contract back mm-hmm. as mm-hmm. quickly as you would like it to, so that's okay. when those injuries are going to happen. Uh-huh. The dynamic stretching, what it does is you're pretty much mimicking what you're going to do. So you're warming up, you're getting blood flow into the area, you're warming up the joint, warming up the muscle by doing this constant repetitive stretching, giving the body a chance to, hey, here's what I'm going to do. So let's get it going. It's kind of like warming up your car, which is what dynamic stretching will do for you. And so it gets the muscles warm and ready, gets them, because they're warm, they're more flexible, meaning that they will move more the way you want them to, as opposed to stretching them out and holding them out there.
And this component of dynamic stretching, I'm going to add, since I have some daughters who are still playing soccer, has been a part of a very short 15-minute warm-up program that has been pretty well demonstrated to markedly decrease anterior cruciate or ACL ligament injuries in girls, which is almost epidemic in young girl soccer players. So that this is part of an exercise program that has benefited, so that static stretching may not be very good, whereas this dynamic warming up kinds of thing is a much more helpful. I have a number of callers who have mentioned and wanted to share their experience, and I don't think I have the time today, so I want to thank Larry and Mary, who particularly have talked about extremely beneficial programs that they've initiated and started with. But I do want to ask, comment on one email that Bill has given us, and he talks about, wants us to answer the question about exercise and blood pressure. Is it ever too high not to recommend exercise? How often do you have to exercise to benefit blood pressure? And what type of exercise or equipment might be recommended? I don't know if you feel comfortable with that kind of somewhat medically questioned business about exercise and blood pressure.
As far as when is it too high to exercise, that I'm not in a position to answer. However, yes, exercise absolutely does benefit blood pressure and helps to decrease blood pressure. I have a few clients who have actually been able to come off of blood pressure medication because of a combination of strength training and cardio training. So the easiest way to start working on that would be with something like a walking program. Getting into more, without knowing about specific meds and things like that to control the blood pressure, I don't want to.
Yeah. And I'm not an expert either on this, and I don't want to make too much of a recommendation, but I think the general idea would be to, one, talk with your physician if you're interested, and I'm sure and hope he will encourage you to exercise, and you start slow, and as you hopefully see some improvement, then you can do more.
Mm-hmm.
Another couple of emails and questions have related to other ways of doing things, and we've only got about a minute or so. Pilates, Tai Chi, what's the pros and cons? Any comments about different ways of doing exercise and movement?
They're all great. The most important thing, and the one of the reasons that I think exercise is becoming hopefully more popular, is right now there are so many options out there. You can pick anything you want, and there's going to be some kind of class or some kind of group that can help you to move in the way that you want to move. So if you are 70 and you want to look at gymnastics, you can probably find someone who can help you with that. If you are a new Tai Chi person, you've heard about some other sort of exercise program, there's pretty much something out there that will fit everybody.
30 seconds. What's your message you want to leave us with?
Get up, get out, get moving.
And eat less, maybe.
Eat less is, yes, absolutely.
Don't smoke and don't drink too much. Those are the things. But thanks very much. It's been just wonderful to get your information.
Thank you.
Next week, this is Jenny Grupp that was with us today. If those are you listening, if you go to our website, you can find a link to her blog, and you can email her about specific questions as well. Next week, we'll be discussing pediatric urology. Those are disorders of the urinary tract system involving infants, children, and adolescents with local urologist Dr. David Bomolowski. So tune into your health and learn more next Monday, December 29th at 2 p.m. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@ksKA.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.